Welcome to the Planet Podcast. We are here today talking with some good friends of mine, and we're talking about the issue of IP television or IPTV. Here we have some guests today. Why don't you introduce yourself, guys?
All right, I'm Rob Blatt. I'm a web producer and podcast producer out of Brooklyn, New York. We're recording this in my studio.
It's a lovely studio, too.
And I'm Kelly Sutton. I'm a recent college graduate, one of Blip TV's newest employees. I'm a junior software engineer there. And I also started a website called Hack College.
Okay. So today we're talking about IP television. One thing that a lot of consumers are confused about. IP television is a way of offering television over a digital feed where each channel is officially, when you have IPTV, is treated as individual IP addresses for each stream. And we're basically going to talk about IP television adoption in America, and particularly what people know about it and what people view about it. And first, we're going to start off in three parts for this podcast. The first part, we'll be talking about the different kind of IP television systems that are available in the United States, from the different competitors, what they offer, and just, you know, what kind of features they have. The next section we're going to be talking about is particularly about the different boxes that they have available for doing IP television set, and not necessarily the official IPTV, but other providers that allow you to aggregate content from the internet, such as your Boxy boxes or your Roku boxes. And last, we're going to each individually talk about our own viewpoints on IPTV and what it offers for the future of television in America. So we're going to talk about IPTV. Who here happens to have IPTV at home at all?
I mean, I think we'll probably be talking about this a lot, but it probably depends on exactly how broadly you define IPTV. My roommate owns a TV and a cable box, and I chip in for that for the internet, but I never use it. So most of the content that I watch is primarily online, mostly through YouTube, Hulu, Netflix, Blip. If that falls within our definition of IPTV, I am a huge consumer of it.
My personal definition for IPTV is particularly the where you have that IP channel where it's like you have a server on the back end, which is saying each individual IP address is a different channel or different, you know, content feed, essentially.
Yours is internet protocol.
Mine is the backbone stuff. Mine is the Unix engineer in the, you know, in the heart of me that I come back from. With my background. So what's your viewpoint on it, Rob?
I don't fall so much into the internet protocol television camp only because I have a TiVo box, which does certain things. One of the things it does not do is connect to a specific IP address to get a video feed. We're going to get into it later, but how I view it is internet-provided television instead of internet protocol television. And in that sense, you know, whether it be on getting Netflix streamed to wherever or getting subscribing to an RSS feed that downloads video, or in the case of I view my cable pipe as just a stream. It's a stream that's recorded and then waits for me. The hour-long lie to me from Fox takes an hour to download. And once it's on my computer, which is the TiVo box, then I can access that file when I want to. But in terms of the real protocol, internet protocol television, I don't have anything that can do that.
I do find that kind of interesting. I like your definition of that, the internet-provided TV versus, you know, internet protocol TV. I think that's the – I haven't ever heard it put so succinctly as that. That's actually the best way of saying it. You, sir, five Kool-Aid points.
Yes.
So is like the by the book definition of IPTV, that's essentially saying like if I navigate to 1.1.1, just some channel, some IP address out there, there will just be a constant like RTMP stream of data, which
pretty
is
much.
Okay, so that's like the channel, and then
yeah, basically one of the widest used IPTV networks is actually the one that's done in France. Most of the TV over there is done through either satellite, through like someone like Sky TV, or through local IPTV networks, which is using a fiber backbone infrastructure. They basically have a box that's able to equivocate. You basically their DNS is channel 1, channel 2, channel 3. To an IP address for each different channel. And so they have these individual boxes that are providing the service. And you can have any ISP you want, really, if you don't want to use the fiber, you know, channel to get that access. But granted, you'll be limited by how many people are using the TV at one time. Other service providers that are similar to that, like, say, in America, are your Verizon Fios. The one thing that's sad about Verizon Fios is that you have to have their Fios service with their Fios TV service. You can't have like another Fios service provider who might be a reseller and then their TV. So it's very difficult to, you know, create your own package of other providers to get the cheapest thing usually that
now,
way.
Verizon, and I assume this would be the same for UVerse from AT&T.
Yes. Actually, yes. AT&T is also an IP
they're competing.
Internet protocol TV.
Right, right. So the question that I have about that is they're actually connecting to a server that's not Verizon-owned or AT&T-owned. It's you're connecting to the actual channel. You know, what if it's CNN, you're connecting to Time Warner somewhere?
No, you actually are still connecting to a server that's located within Verizon within AT&T.
Is it all one box?
If it's
all one IP address, then I argue that my cable provider, Time Warner, that I'm getting all of my cable digitally, is doing the same thing. However, it's a hardwired one-to-one kind of IP connection.
Yeah, exactly. The way that they work with that is particularly is when you're sending that digital signal, you're getting all the channels at one time.
Right.
That's how they treat it with that. So when you're going, like, say, a digital service provider who's Time Warner or Comcast, they're using the entire spectrum to send you all the channels at one time, except Comcast recently switched over to a service where they're calling it switch packet television, where you only get the signal from the channel you requested at one time.
That's SVD. I just got a notification about it.
Yeah.
My TiVo is going to stop working as
exactly.
a result.
You have to have a special box and a little mirror.
I think it's SDV.
Yes.
Yeah, but you
switched
need
a digital video. Yes.
Yeah. Time Warner is switching over to that too.
Yeah. And so basically that's, taking each individual user has a private connection for Comcast between them and the server location. And that server location is sending you a specific, you know, video feed. And so when you change the channel, it's a two-way communication to say, hey, change the feed on your end to give me a new one. And so the one thing with Comcast version is particular, it takes like a few seconds to change the channel over. Ooh. More than...
It's like reading on the Nook.
That's a low blow, sir. That's a low blow.
Only if you have a Nook.
You know what? Sometimes
I think more people have Jujus than they have Nooks. More people bought the Kin.
Actually, you'd be surprised. I've seen quite a few Nooks. A lot of people I've seen have.
No, I've seen a lot of them too. Yeah. I just like making fun of people with inferior technology.
Some people don't like having photons bombarding their eyes like a visual gangbang from an iPad.
Whatever. And then some. But anyway, so
we digress.
IPTV.
Yes.
So it sounds like you're. I mean, even in the definition of the conversation, we're widening what IPTV actually is, because if you're connecting, I mean, if I would argue, if you're connecting to one IP address, you're not really. It's not like the internet in that sense. It's just replacing your coax signal with, it's replacing the copper to the home with fiber to the home.
Well, it's not necessarily just fiber. It's any means of doing high-end broadband connection. I mean, the average...
In the case of Verizon and AT&T specifically.
The Comcast one where it's the switch digital SDV, it's, I believe that they use a 12 megabit per second total pipe for sending the individual streams.
Okay.
But it can actually be dropped down based on the channel because they still provide support for the other ones. So, for example, MTV is running at, like, I think 7 megabits per second for their HD channels.
Okay.
And then, like, say, when someone like HBO is running at 10. megabits per second. Mm-hmm. And so you've probably seen these reports when people compare, you know, Blu-ray versus Apple TV versus, you know, for the video qualities. And you can definitely see a difference in the artifacting and encoding from different providers. So, like, that's the one thing also is you'll see, based on your internet speed, you'll see a higher quality based on whoever your provider is.
You would think that due to all of this, the quality, overall quality would be going up. But I don't think that's necessarily the case.
Well, the one thing that's interesting is, particularly with the Verizon Fios, you will get, from some of the comparisons, based in your area. Mm-hmm. It's all related to what the CO does in your area, the
cable operator.
Thank you. Cable operator box or, you know, location. And for most of the times, from what I've seen, Verizon Fios will have a better video quality than that of Comcast when you do a direct comparison. The one thing, though, is you still have to figure some way. I mean, a lot of people, like myself, I see this as an issue with IPTV, is that a lot of times in America, they particularly want you to stay to a you can't just dial into an address. You have to have a separate box. You have to have this box that you then pay rent for. While you have other providers who might actually let you just dial in that IP address like you would. Like, it's almost like going back to the days of RealPlayer in a way. But, like, there are people who are actually able to type in non-encrypted IP addresses for their IPTV networks and get them playing through VLC, for example. And you can control these boxes as well. Like, the ones in France are fully supported by home theater systems like Myth TV and stuff like that as well. So they all can just automatically do the decoding, and the box will act as a decoder if it's encrypted channels.
That's kind of like what, from my understanding, what how the digital systems claimed to work from the beginning, in terms of they were arguing that, so like you're mentioning, that the difference between HBO and MTV, and that the depending on the type of event or type of thing you were watching, you would have a higher or lower quality based on the compression, because if there is a sports game on, then that would have a higher dedication of bandwidth than the soap opera at the same time. But with this, I would really hope that everything would be consistent in terms of
the SDV service.
Well, in terms of the SDV, and in terms of switching like that, because you would think that, okay, well, if I have a dedicated 12 meg pipe, I want to use that 12 meg pipe to be, okay, now give me 12 megs of MTV, give me 12 megs of Comedy Central, and, or, you know, if I can't get that connection, whatever it is, the maximum would be. That would be, I imagine that is the dream of all of this, to have the highest possible quality come at you from whatever channel it is that you're watching.
And that meg is, just for the listeners of the podcast, is particularly megabits per second when it comes to the video quality that you're getting in. And a lot of the times, most of the channels have to have support also. Like, for example, Comcast for a long time, even though it said HBO was 5.1 supported, would only still have the stereo track going over there, you know, the signal. And what's really sad is you still have a lot of HD channels, like in the United States, Comcast doesn't have Cartoon Network HD. And I'm a big fan of HD cartoons. Mm-hmm. So the only person you can get that from is Dish Network, and it's the West Coast feed only, not the East Coast feed. So you actually have to pay more on top of that to get the West Coast feed as well.
Yes.
I know. Television, it sucks that way.
Yeah.
Well, there's almost, you know, I don't even want to bring it up, but like I know that the promise of Google TV is to hopefully alleviate some of that, where if it's on TV, you'll be able to type it in and find it. The TiVo does the same thing. All of the higher end cable boxes that you would think of traditionally do that kind of thing, where you know, you're gonna just find the show. I don't care what channel it's on. Just whenever Star Trek Next Generation is on, record it.
It's like whatever area it's from, whatever district, you know, region it comes from.
Right.
Find me that golden chalice.
Find me new episodes of Babylon 5. Find me whatever it is. You know, I want
Star Trek is better.
I know. I was giving another example, really, but I can't think of a sci-fi show that's on the air right now. But it
Manimal.
Don't know what that is, but it sounds hilarious.
It's the 80s for you. Oh, was that 70s or was that 80s?
Oh, I have no idea.
Okay. Guy turns into a panther creature. And he solves crimes.
Oh, of course. What else would you do in
your panther?
It's
like the Michael Jackson Black or White video at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, totally. That's how it works.
The one thing you brought up particularly was things like TiVo and also being able to watch things on demand.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly, what's your viewpoint on this? You haven't been talking much.
Yeah, TV is such a mess right now, and it's such a mess for the consumer, and it's such a mess for the MSOs and the cable operators, that I'm holding my breath for some sort of, TV apocalypse coming very, very soon. And I think...
The shoot your TV?
No. Just rather than Lost airing at, Tuesday, rest in peace, but rather than Lost airing at Tuesdays at 10 p.m., it's a file that becomes available for download at 10 p.m., because really we've seen that's how the web works, and you can still mimic the the lean back, I'm just going to channel surf behavior with that type of model. But I think everything that we've talked about so far is kind of just a band-aid on a really, really complicated problem and even Google TV, it's just a band-aid on a complicated problem,
It's fixing things on the client end instead of the server.
Yeah. This is a hilarious anecdote that I love using, but there's a show out there in the wild right now which comments on internet culture and internet videos on a pretty, pretty major network.
Which one would this be?
But you can't watch the show in its entirety online, because of the way the contracts are laid out for all of these individual cable operators. If they wanted to air one episode of the show in its entirety, they would have to cut 50 different contracts, or however many different operators there are for cable operators out there, because these operators have bargained for the rights for this channel. We own the rights to play these episodes in their entirety. So what the show does is they just cut out all of the commercials and just put all of the clips of the show online. So it's not one seamless 17-minute viewing experience.
It's the YouTube effect of part one, part two,
exactly,
part three.
Exactly.
Fun.
And as long as you have that type of, all of these band-aids going on, there's still not going to be, a solution to this really serious problem to the way people are watching, things that aren't, prosumer web video and mm-hmm. things that aren't film, but somewhere in the middle there.
A lot of channels have that issue, even ones that I assume own their own distribution. If you try to watch any show that airs on MSNBC,
mm-hmm.
It'll autoplay clip by clip by clip.
Yeah.
But there isn't, the exception, I believe, is Rachel Maddow, but it's clip by clip by clip. It's not one experience. The same with, I have a feeling I know what show you're talking about and the network, so I'll say it's the same experience with The Colbert Report and The Daily Show, where it's clip
it rhymes
by clip.
With Josh.
Yeah.
3.0.
Yeah.
Which is new show on Digg, supposedly.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Right.
Okay. So, when it comes down to it, it seems like the one thing in particular with America, mm-hmm. IP television as an internet protocol television has been fully adopted in Europe. They adopted it in Japan and most of Asia as well.
Probably South Korea.
South Korea is high up in there for its IP TV as well.
Their internet connections.
Yeah, what's funny is there are a lot of things about Korea that's very funny too. Digress real quick. For example, Skype has its own cell phone provider.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you guys ever been?
No.
I have friends that go there all the time.
My younger sister, of all people, is actually Korean. She's adopted. So I went to South Korea 3 years ago, mm-hmm. absolutely mind-blowing. Like, I don't know why we're so jazzed about FaceTime right now. Like, South Korea's had that for 3 or 4 years. Like, they've had the, your cell phone is a digital TV antenna, essentially, for 4 or 5 years. Like, they have cell phone reception on the subways.
Nice.
Like, it's nuts.
We got that for Verizon and Sprint in D.C.
They're talking about it in New York, but I don't think it's going
to
happen.
Yeah, the one thing with New York, to digress with this topic, the reason why New York's not going to have it anytime soon is because they're forcing them to, whoever builds it has to provide support for all the other carriers as well.
All right.
So it's like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to support you. I don't want to support you.
You do it. No, yeah. You do it. Right. No, you do it.
That makes even less sense in the United States because it's like, hey, AT&T, build out a CDMA network while you're at it. It's like, what?
That's, yeah.
Yeah. No, it doesn't make any sense.
But the one thing it really does come down to in America in particular with anything we're having issues with holding back in technology, it is people holding to old business models. A lot of people, for like yourselves, mentioned about how you watch a lot of TV, you know, after the fact, like after it's been recorded. You have your Hulus, which are, you know, becoming very popular and is on the verge of possibly replacing TV, but at the same time, not because the content producers like the money from old ways of doing it.
Yeah, and the weird, kind of like jumping off of that, and the weird thing that I'm also one like speculating about this TV apocalypse thing is, if it ever happens, is I have a funny feeling that as the ways of measuring TV viewing become more granular than Nielsen ratings, you're going to see a huge shift in the way media buys are done. Because still in like in old media, like if you're spending money on TV, it's just you do it by the Nielsen ratings. It's like this show has a 3 in the demographic that we want, so we're going to give them like $3 million for a few commercials. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but that's still the way media buys are done. But you know, Nielsen, like that's just a single number. Like that's not a CPM. That is not a CPC. That is not even close to a CPA.
Right. It's held to a lower standard than with the web, but CPM. It is. Well, no, the TV measurement is held. Mm-hmm. It's a lower standard than the web, but it's higher. Has more prominence and more importance when you can say, no, I know that.
Yeah.
2 million people watch this.
Yeah, and I mean, you still can't exactly get this with like a CPM, but you have a pretty good idea of how attentive people are in your videos because, like, you don't know if someone's like watching TV and they're like doing something on their laptop and it's just in the background. Like, is that worth more or less than someone who's intently watching the season finale of their favorite show?
I think when it also comes down to when it comes to popularity shows, you almost have to look at how you pay for advertising as television in general for technology is all paid for by advertising.
Yep.
You really have to now look at the social graph, like how big that television show is talked about. I mean, there are a lot of shows that are so viral and just so popular through non-traditional means. One show that was recently canceled was Party Down, which was on Stars. And it was on a Friday night at 10 o'clock, and most people are not home. And originally when they started the show...
That's the kill spot.
Yeah,
that's
exactly. It's what killed Quantum Leap, damn it.
But what's where shows go to die is Friday nights.
But what's interesting is the show was on to its second season, and it was popular because it was available on Netflix, which was the majority of its viewership.
Huh.
But... I mean, as being that the show was on Netflix and it's on a premium channel, there were no commercials. So it's very interesting that the show was still canceled. The show was extremely popular. It was pulling in the same numbers it would have done probably normally, even for the time slot it was, because it was being played through Netflix. It was doing very well. I was heard. So,
well, it's a theme that pops up kind of often is that, a few years ago, it was iTunes saves The Office. Was that iTunes? The Office stuck around because of how popular it was on iTunes and how much attention it had due to that distribution, which is interesting because it doesn't help. That kind of thing doesn't help traditional TV. And IPTV, no matter how awesome we talk about it, is it's still traditional TV. It's still the experience of pick up the remote, press the button. What's on right now? This is what's on right now on this channel. This is what's on this channel. All it does is it saves the cable companies some dollars by not having to, you know, by being able to use this digital technology and push people over and not stream things that people aren't watching and to really know. I mean, the SDV, I have a feeling we're going to walk out of here. We're going to get the acronym wrong, but this switched video.
The switched digital video.
I mean, now cable companies will know exactly what people are watching, and not because they're going to have to serve it individually. But it still doesn't help the fact that TV is still this experience that you have to sit down, and at 10 o'clock you know that you have to watch Party Down, because that's when it's on. Mm. All of these internet provided television services are creeping up on this. And, you know, Jake and Amir might be 2 minutes long, but it's consistent. It's consistently in the stream of shows that I watch every week. And hey, this is pretty convenient. Wouldn't it be awesome if I could get sitcom B on the same way? Well, it would be, but I can't yet.
And we'll talk about that in a few seconds. We'll talk about particularly the aggregation of cross-platform services. But first, we're going to take a moment from our sponsors. And from our first sponsor, GoDaddy. They want to let you know the inside scoop. VeriSign, the registry for .com and .net domains, will be raising their prices on July 1st. That means that GoDaddy's standard $7.49 price from GoDaddy will be going up too. So if you want to beat the price increase and you need to act now, just use promo code PLAN83 for 10% off your entire order when you check out for your discount online. Remember, prices are going up July 1st, which has already happened. So head over to GoDaddy.com and grab your domain now. So we're going to talk about the aggregation, particularly with devices or services. And the first device, I think, personally, that comes up to me when I think of aggregating of your content would be the first big player on the block, and that would be Boxy. Boxy was the first major contender for aggregating all of your media, both on your computer and online, that I could really think of that offered the kind of services they offered, both connecting Hulu, YouTube, a various amount of channels, Blip TV, your company was there, as well as Revision 3, which hosted your other show, and Major League Baseball as well was on there too. So as long as you had the subscription for that, you also had Netflix. With their most recent version, their new beta build of Boxy, you can actually create a playlist of all your favorite shows, so they will play in succinct order no matter who the provider was and what app you were using it from. That's one provider I can think of. There are a couple other ones.
TiVo has been doing it for years, and it had been doing it for years before then.
Not well.
it doesn't matter if it was no one was doing it well. Well, it was available to, you know, to subscribe. Granted, you had to use the remote control to type in and the feed of an RSS feed, but it was available, and they had tried to get, you know, they were trying to get to list podcasts that you could download or whatever, but it was available in your feed, and it's available. You're talking about like have your one feed of all this stuff. That is how it works on the TiVo, is that you have one feed of everything. Mm-hmm. So when you download whatever to the TiVo, it's just in. Or when you transfer stuff from, they now provide software so you can transfer stuff from your computer to the TiVo in order to watch it on the TiVo.
Well, the one issue, though, that was about TiVo, that when I first used it, I only used it with the Series 2 boxes, not with the Series 3 or the HD ones, is that you actually had to type in all the addresses.
Nope, so you still do.
And that took me out of the whole, quote-unquote, lean back, you know, playing of the system. You had to be very... typed in wrong, deleted too much, don't!
They have a few hundred shows now that they have the feeds,
the single click,
the built-in, the single click, but the rest, it's the difficult side.
That's one reason I brought up Boxy, was because I think they were the first provider that actually had a you point click, add the app, and then do you want to add the single shows, or do you want to just automatically subscribe to the RSS feed? It was very, you know, lean back focused, and their new boxy box with the keyboard they have. That's a very pretty little remote. Like, I remember at CES flipping the remote over because, you know, Abner Rowan, who's the CEO, showed it to me. And I was like, wait, there's a keyboard? And it has those little plastic chiclet keys on it. And it's all Bluetooth. I'm like, I want just that even.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool remote. Does the D-Link Boxy Box have a release date yet?
It's supposed to be in November that they're releasing it. So
Vapor-vember?
Oh, hush up. But it... supposedly, it will be finalized for November release. And the reason why they were waiting for it was that they were waiting for Flash 10 fully support, 10.1 support for it. So, but other contenders for this are the recently announced Google TV box, which will be embedded in both Sony television sets and also have standalone boxes from Logitech. And that will allow
to start.
And What were your guys' initial thoughts of that when you first saw, like, the Google, you know, keynote event that they had for it?
I worry that the fact that you can access the Android marketplace on it. I was ranting before we started about the utter garbage dump the Android marketplace is, and I'm persistent that 90% of Android developers don't care. And they don't put any effort into their apps, and that it doesn't matter how many apps are in that store, because anyone who uses an Android phone knows that it's all trash. So to have that ability,
Java is one of the highest, used programs on the internet right now for programming languages.
So in order to have an app store for your TV is nice, but like there's a reason that Yahoo widgets never caught on. And it wasn't just their lack of distribution. It was that no one wanted it. I like the ability to search my TV and the programs that are coming up and to add feeds and whatever. But it's, as Kelly was saying before, it's just a Band-Aid. It's nothing new. It's, you know, it's trying to fix
the stopgap.
It's trying to fix this on the client side instead of on the server side.
Yeah, and I'm curious because Google's entering a very crowded marketplace, and Google can do a lot of things well, as they've proven. But they've also proven that like they can also fail. Like companies fail occasionally, and so I'm really skeptical that the Google TV is going to be significant enough, or it's going to have enough cachet among consumers where someone is going to go to the store and say, I need a significant number of people, not just like, you know, the three of us in this room maybe, are going to go to the store and say, I need to have the Sony TV with the Google built in. And they'll probably call it the Google.
I need the computer.
Because Sony TVs actually right now already have a service called Bivel, which performs very similarly to like TiVo or Roku or Boxy or any of these, like same type of just type in the address of a media RSS feed and you get your shows.
And actually they have a Sony specific IPTV network as well that I know of, that when you plug the Ethernet cable and you get several channels that are only available through Sony.
Yeah.
Is that the real IPTV?
That's real IPTV. That's Internet Protocol TV.
Nice.
So there are a few things that Google could do with Google TV that would really, really change the way people just view videos, both online and on TV. I'm going to take this opportunity to plug a little project that I made. It's not very good, but it's just called...
plug away, sir.
It's just called Later, like 3Ls, Ader.com. And all it does is it's Instapaper for YouTube videos. So you click on it, you get a bookmarklet, you click on it, it marks that, and then you watch it later. Google should do that with Google TV, where since they own YouTube, obviously you can connect those up in some pretty interesting ways where you can just be at work and your coworkers are just sending you funny videos all day long and you can just bookmark those. And then once you get home, you just sit down and say, hey, play all these videos from YouTube that my coworkers sent me.
A version of, kind of like the Chrome to phone stuff, not instant, just to a queue.
Yeah. Because more and more, And Blip is kind of like right at that weird, turning...
Crossroads?
Turning, yeah, crossroads between...
Fork.
Like quick viral videos and studio-produced content. And so when I'm watching videos, I don't really care, like, who makes it. Like, if it's entertaining, I want to watch it, whether that's, like, 30 seconds of some guy falling off a motorcycle on YouTube or it's, I don't know, Firefly. Like,
right.
Like, I put that all in the same stream, and I'll just sit back and watch it for an hour and put ads in there, and I will not complain about that service.
Now, what's kind of interesting is that to talk about, you know, we talked about, you know, the Boxy. We talked about, you know, Google TV. There's also the Roku, mm-hmm. which is another service that offers you the ability of having channels to watch. You have to go to each individual channel. But the idea that, you know, you're having content being produced, I think, is one of the biggest things. I mean, when you were talking about, you know, individual stuff that's produced in studios versus stuff that's produced, you know, by people falling off ladders, it's almost with internet-provided TV that isn't from traditional media, I look at it almost like the evolution of single-celled organisms to advanced complex organisms. Because at first it was these like 1 minute, 2 minute videos. Mm-hmm. And now you have like, you know, your iJustine who does 30 minute videos. And so like the first gateway drug of videos on YouTube are the first viral videos. And if they're popular enough, Google's like, here's your partner, you know, make more.
Yeah.
And Google, just announced with YouTube that they're having their grant process that if you have videos that are popular, they'll then start paying you to produce more mm-hmm. because of their in-content advertising. And you're starting to see a lot of people making a lot of money from just random viral videos. Like there was one recently of a girl who said, this is how you trick people to think you're pretty. And within literally a day, it had over 2 million hits. Mm-hmm. And the girl... All her other videos were just, you know, rather interesting about her, you know, working as a dancer, even though she has a graduate degree and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this video just caught on like wildfire. And I checked it just the other day and it was close to 4 million hits. So.
Yeah.
And that like a million hits supposedly can get you $50,000 on YouTube right now.
A billion?
One million.
Oh, 1 million.
Because the example,
I heard that too. It's
like if you're getting a billion hits, that's
you've just got one ninth of the world.
Yeah, maybe you should be on the real TV, making the real money.
Yeah, exactly.
But like, but no, for example, talking about viral videos, which mm-hmm. is plays into IPTV or internet provided TV.
You're telling me that you think that she just made $2 million off of
made like. Close to
$200,000. Okay.
For example, the one video of the kid who was coming home from the dentist.
And David after dentist. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. David at the dentist. The parents made from the views, I believe, over $150,000 so far from just the view clicks.
And they got to be on that Josh show.
Yes. 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 And also at RaffleCon, which is held by several friends of mine, Rachel Mercer, who's an amazing person.
And Tim Huang.
Huh?
And Tim Huang.
Oh, yeah, Tim Huang, with his powers of the kitty icons. But that's really an interesting thing where viral videos are the precursor to television from the internet. I mean, we're all content producers here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the first podcasts were all audio. Now they're all audio and video. And you're starting to see user-generated TV shows. Like, for example, Pioneer One was 100% funded by Kickstarter. And other projects like that, being able to produce television shows, which are on par with extended cable before extended cable became popular.
Yeah.
But they are becoming full-length TV shows that plan an entire series arc of, you know, the BBC-style seven-episode arcs. What's your view for the future of that kind of thing with content? Because you have these boxes that are able to aggregate it. And you have your service providers like Blip TV, for example, mm-hmm. can aggregate all these feeds. Like people can just post videos.
Yeah.
And so if you have services, what's your view on the video generated content particularly? I'll start with Kelly to talk about this one.
Yeah. So Blip, for me, it's always easiest to talk about like what Blip does because that's also very, very close to my personal philosophy on what web video is going to look like in the next 5 years. So Blip tries to help create... sustainable web video content. And to us, like, it's damn entertaining, but like viral videos are not sustainable. And the tragic thing about that girl that just got 4 million views with YouTube is that she might not be seeing all of that money if she wasn't opted into the partner program beforehand, because then she gets nothing. That's not to put down YouTube or anything like that, but you know, we need to kind of like look back at like 2-3 years ago and say, okay, of the original viral videos that were put out, like Tezan Day is a good example. Like, what does his career look like right now?
Tezan Day is the man who put on Chocolate Rain,
yeah,
for those
yeah,
who might
yeah.
not know.
And actually Tim Hwang and, Rachel Mercer and another guy named Jamie Wilkinson,
yes.
used to be at Rockaboom. He's at a company out in San Francisco called 140 Proof. They like really looked into this, and Jamie Wilkinson has this like grandmaster like theory that getting a viral hit, if you want to be successful online, is one of the worst things you could possibly do.
Because it's all people. It's the typecasting.
It's exactly the typecasting thing. Like what one hit wonder bands exist as one hit wonder bands because they are one hit wonders. They have that song that is super amazingly successful, for a very, very short period of time. And then everything is going to constantly be compared back to that going forward in the future.
There was a documentary about this, not long ago. I want my 2 minutes back or 3 minutes back.
Yeah.
And it did exactly this of following around kind of some early YouTube stars. And it was like watching Waiting for Guffman, but it was real. Because a lot of these people moved to LA. They thought they were going to be huge celebrities based on this early success.
Yeah.
And it was like, no one is any like no there's a there's like one or two people that do some stuff that's kind of followed, kind of still has a following, but for the most part it was like watching a Christopher Guest movie, but it was real life.
And so like, yeah, and like you look at like the people who are making really, really good livings doing web video right now, like Justine, for example.
How do you pronounce her last name?
Zarek.
Thank you, Zarek.
She had that like one super popular like original iPhone
receipt bill,
it was, like 300 pages or whatever. But she was doing videos before that, and she's kept doing videos after that. You don't really hear referred to as the iPhone bill girl. Like a lot of people will. Like a lot of publications will refer to her as that when they're trying to kind of lay some context to who this woman actually is. But she continues to create videos on a weekly basis that,
like, parodies of music videos and things like that.
All of those don't get millions of views, but they get tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of views. And that's really, I mean, that's what advertisers traditionally look for. Is like
the aggregate.
How can you sustain an audience? Because it's very, very difficult to. You can't sell ads against like, well, this one video is going to be super, super, or we think this video or this user is going to have like a super, super successful video one of these days. But we don't know. So do you want to buy 4 million impressions against them or not?
Well, I think the one thing is talking about advertising with videos. I think that's something we can talk about in the next segment. But want to talk about the other advertiser that we have with us today.
Yeah.
And that is VoIPO. Do you need cheap voiceover IP service? Check out VoIPO. For $8.25 a month, you can have free eFax, unlimited calling international and stateside. And guess what? They're also fully SIP and soft phone supported with 100% US-based customer support. Visit VoIPO.com/2179 and see what the best VoIP over IP provider listed on BroadbandReports.com can do for you. So we're talking about content creation in particular and, when it comes to the actual shows that are available on the internet. And when it comes down to actual advertisers, with IPTV, you have the traditional model where big shows by big content producers are going to be good. But if we're talking about the individual people like ourselves, one idea you could always do is that you have the person's video become popular at get-go, And then the advertiser can be like, we can see the futures in it. That way they can like hedge their bets against it. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, like I posted a video of from E3 2009 of Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, Olivia Harrison, and Yoko Ono coming on stage from the Xbox thing. I'm still getting a comment or view daily on that thing mm-hmm. since then. Mm-hmm. And like I constantly, like whenever I get a comment, I'm like, I know it's going to be that video because someone keeps making a comment to it.
Yeah.
So there's certain things I think that you can look at where if something is continuously getting a comment or continuously getting views, yeah. you know, you might be able to put an advertisement against that. You're not necessarily mm-hmm. hedging your bets beforehand. I mean, you can always do that too.
Yeah.
What do you think about that idea of where you advertise after the fact, after you see that video was already popular, people are going to still click on it?
Yeah. So that I believe is usually referred to as kind of a remnant advertising mm-hmm. because and traditional TV works the same way as well, which is why infomercials exist. Or I guess infomercials against reruns would be an apt example. Like, this is obviously something that isn't necessarily contextual or recent, but people still want to watch it.
Like your favorite episode of Star Trek, which is replayed, and you know that it's on, so you might sit through it because exactly. it was rated as the most popular one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or it's just Star Trek. I mean, let's be honest.
Hey, I got to say, my favorite episodes are any ones with, you know, Captain Picard and the Borg, you know, when it comes down to it. You know, season finale of Star Trek Next Generation, good stuff. Or series finale, actually. So.
Yeah. So like, with selling ads against, like, old popular content, like, that's a good idea. It's just like, a little bit more difficult to do. Mm. Terrible way to end that thought.
Well, it's also Kelly,
very helpful, but pointless.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't necessarily help with having a video that was popular and remains relatively popular. Like, you know, it's getting 10 views a day, but that still means at the end of the month it's getting a few hundred, and at the end of the year, hey, you've got a few thousand, a few extra thousand on there, or if it's 100 views a day or whatever. It does mean that you can kind of line that up with future success, or at least with your future. Maybe it's not success, but it's future plans to say, you know, it's what we experience when we get into a trade show for the first time as press. You know, you get the foot in once, and then you're like, it doesn't matter how bad your content was from CES last year, but you have it. And you point whoever it is to the
growing snowball.
You point it to, hey, look, I did CES last year. And then when you do CES this year, all of a sudden they're like, okay, well, you know, last year we didn't give you access to this, this, or this because it was your first time and we didn't really think you'd come back. But now that you're back, well, now you have like the full access to everything. And then all of a sudden you're making, even if your videos get the same amount and you know beforehand, all of a sudden you're making more videos, which means you just get more aggregate views overall because maybe you have the same number of people. Not the same people coming to view it. I mean, it's how I got to CES last year, based with a network that was just doing a few hundred videos from CES. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the advertising against those videos paid for all of our costs. Yeah. And gave us all a little money on top of it. Yeah. So, I mean, that kind of stuff does exist, but I think it's harder to let a faceless advertiser know that, you know, oh, I'm going to do all of this great stuff that's going to have a very high search volume for a short period of time. It's not serialized content, but it's planned content.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that I think that it's currently really difficult to advertise against. But there are networks, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like Blip, that you can kind of set up an advertising account beforehand, whether it be just through a Google ad or a pre-roll or whatever. And, you know, if you get popular, hey, that's some cash in the pocket. But if you don't get popular, a few dozen people watched a 10-second clip that they didn't want to.
I think one thing particularly with content production, there are only a few providers that let you do high definition video longer than 10 minutes if you don't pay for an account.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, I remember Rever was one of them. I forget, what's the length that BlipTV does?
We don't have a specific length, but mm-hmm. we do have a file limit, which is a gig
okay.
right now, yeah.
And so, like, some you can get some shows now for high definition under a gig, but the quality sometimes will drop. And so, depending on what you're doing, you know, if you want to get, say, a live show like your Techzillas or, the shows that are talking about tech, things that are talking about products,
mm-hmm.
those don't have to have the higher quality video. But if you want to have your video that's like actual TV shows, those tend to have a higher, bit rate, I think. And so I think you're going to start seeing more and more of those shows come, and hopefully the networks, will come, the providers for the hosting for it will come with them. I think one thing particular that you also have with IPTV or, video on the internet is you have, like, for example, Hulu now has their Hulu Plus service, and you pay $10 a month, which gives you the entire back catalog of all the videos that are on Hulu. Actually, a specific number of them, not all of them, but they're going to add all of them. And then also HD. But you still have to have advertisements. And a lot of people complained about that. But at the same time, you're going to be using it probably to replace a lot of your TV, and you already have advertisements for cable you pay for. But at the same time, in the future, why is the service... Why are people having to pay for that Hulu Plus in the beginning? Because if they're going to have advertisements in all the videos anyway, maybe they should just give that content away. I mean, you have other providers that are doing advertisements against videos as well, and they're giving them away. I mean, just because you have a video... Like, you're going to make money if you want them without ads by going buying the DVD box sets or going to Netflix, I think. And what are your guys' views on that? The idea that, all content can be free, all TV could be free in the future just because there's, ads in them online.
It doesn't work anyway because I pay for access to the Yankees channel, and that has advertising. Mm-hmm. I pay extra, I pay extra on top of like the very basic the $15 or $20 plan for Comedy Central. That has advertising. You're not doing anything different with Hulu Plus. You're still getting less ads.
Yeah, you're getting less ads in the one ad for 1 minute versus, one ad or several ads that are, 12 minutes.
I'm torn on that kind of thing because, it's not a service that can supplement your cable. It's not a service that has the ability to or the volume to. So, you're not paying that much. It's giving you way more than you're paying for. I feel insensitive just saying shut up about it,
mm-hmm.
but shut up. You're still getting a deal.
Yeah. I agree. I think the $9 that the $10 you're basically paying for it. I mean, I'm actually trying to get my parents off television in general. They still want to have flippable channels, and we're going to get the cheapest possible plan, that you can get. But that's still, $30 for that plan. Then $10 for the Hulu Plus, cause we're going to set up a box that has that on there, as well as Netflix. And so we're going to be paying basically $40 for having all the content we want in 720p and, on mostly demand. I think the one issue is that you still have a large populace of the United States and world that are used to the I flip the channels, let's see what's on mentality.
How are you going to watch the Orioles?
Well, you have MBL... applications on several TVs like Samsung and Sony that allow you to watch baseball games.
But they black out local games.
They don't.
Not anymore?
The MLB app lets you watch normally blacked out games based on regional stuff, I believe.
That's the app, not the MLB.TV
service.
Not the
TV series. It's the app that you can get through Roku and through your iPhone or iPod.
Because I know that...
you pay $10 a month for that, I believe, or $12 a month. For their service.
I know that to watch it on the net, for instance, if you're local, it's mm-hmm. blacked out completely, which is also, it's cable provider by cable provider, but local teams are making deals with local cable providers now that if you're already getting the channel, you're allowed to watch it online. So if you have some kind of, you know, if there are some kind of blackout restrictions locally, that you can still get it. But this is like, that's a horrible mess for me to think that I have to now sign into Yankees.com to watch a game with my Time Warner account. And if I don't have a Time Warner account, then I can't pay for it to watch it. It was the same restriction that NBC had with the Olympics everywhere. It's the same restriction that everyone had with the World Cup and the NCAA. Sports seems to be the real holdup. And
so here's the question. How much would you pay to watch a game?
I think
wherever you wanted to. Like, you could watch the next Yankees game, or if you're a Mets fan, not sure.
Yankees.
Okay, so you can watch the next Yankees game for a fee on any device, on any screen you want to. How much would you pay for that?
I would probably pay for the full season. Mm-hmm. I couldn't pay per game.
Mm-hmm.
But for the full season, I'd probably pay like $150 or $200.
Yeah, so see, this is where I personally believe we start running into problems with the system, where it's like, there are a lot of customers who want something and they're willing to shell out their cold hard cash for it, and the technology is there, it's just not configured correctly.
Right.
Like, and this has nothing to do with you wanting to like download or like pirate these games illegally. Like, you are willing to pay for it.
No,
like,
I mean, I paid $15 just so I could get the Android app so I could listen to the radio.
Yeah.
The radio that exists for free, just so I can hear the local Yankees broadcast wherever I am.
Yeah, exactly. So like that's like the big, like people, yeah, like. The world has the technology to make this possible. Like, why doesn't it exist?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the MLB app, it seems, has full support for all their games 7 days back. It doesn't block out any of the things. There's the premium version, and then there's the basic version. And it says here with the premium, you get HD quality where available, portability, which runs on all your devices when you log in, in-game highlights and stats, full game archives, condensed games where it shortens them in the archives, at game day audio. So, you know,
what I've got on the Android right now.
Fantasy player tracker. Then it has for the premium edition, which is $24.95 a month or $79.95 yearly, you get choice of home or away broadcast, DVR controls, pause, rewind, live games, and multi-game views, which allows you to see from multiple camera angles, split screens, or also picture-in-picture. And that seems like that covers all your games, home and away.
If that's the case. And I think maybe I'm mistaking the earlier stuff with the blackouts.
And they also have that available now for the National Hockey League as well, I believe, too. And so I know a lot of
NHL. I think was first with that because
yes, I believe it was. Yeah,
because I mean, who wants to watch hockey?
To all my Canadian fans, I'm sorry.
Interesting tidbit. The CEO of Blip, Mike Hudak, worked at the NHL before starting Blip.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. So, I think what you're going to see is you're going to see premium content. Sports is going to be the one that's always, I think, going to be all sports. Anything that's a live performance is going to have to require that live kind of feed. If it's something that, you know, is like, say, the inauguration or some major world-changing event.
That's true. I don't care about yesterday's game.
Exactly.
In terms of watching the
full thing.
Because
everyone else has seen it. You want to, like, have everyone there watching it for the first time, you know, being de-virginized by, you know, bat hitting a ball.
Right.
For the first time.
Sure.
For the first time.
Right.
Best possible way I could imagine. I don't watch these, you know, sportsy things.
These sportsy,
you know, the idea
of
taking a large mallet and hitting a ball with that cudgel, you know, strange thing to me.
Croquet? A large mallet?
Again, sports.
Cricket?
I'm trying to make a
maybe?
Joke.
Maybe? Oh, those things.
Yeah. The humor where I get things wrong. So, content. Final view, where do you think it's going to go in the next 5 years, 10 years? Kelly?
I think you'll see a lot more hobbyists, like people like ourselves, actually being able to quit their day jobs. Because it's really tragic to watch a very well-written show, nonfiction or fiction, and just say, like, the reason why they're not bigger, the reason why they're not on TV is because they don't have the backing of, they don't have deficit financing, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then you turn on your TV, and it's just absolute garbage. Like there's no demographic for terrible content. and which is how I feel like old media kind of tries to pass off some of this stuff. It's like, well, this is just for the lowest common denominator of people. It's like, yeah, but the writing's terrible. Like, the shows are just bad. Like, a lot of shows are just bad. Whereas online, it's kind of like the Wild West, and there are a lot of bad. There are probably more bad, definitely more bad shows than good. But the people who can write well really, really rise to the top. So,
Rob, 5 and 10 years, where is content production going?
You see, I had an ideal, like, or I didn't have an ideal, but I was kind of more idealistic maybe 2 or 3 years ago, when really, well, like, internet content really was the Wild West, and it wasn't as centralized as it is now. But I really feel like it's going to get harder and harder to be successful online, and it's going to be hard, and not just because of the volume of people, but I think because of these little, it used, you know, the TV and media used to be like the old boys clubs of all these things, but I think we're going back to that. And in terms of, yes, Leo Laporte might be wildly successful. Yes, the folks on Revision 3 might be successful, but I think those networks are solidifying, and the barriers to get into them are going to get higher and higher and higher. You can't get on one of those. You can't walk in to one of those networks and get a chance. You have to be proven, which is the old model of TV. You can't create your own network without being known for doing something else. Dan Benjamin is doing a great job with 5x5, but I knew who Dan Benjamin was and wanted to hear him talk in a podcast before he started that network. Independent voices, I think, are going away. And in 5 to 10 years, we're going to be heading towards the internet, the more popular internet TV, looking like cable did a few years ago, mm-hmm. in terms of, yes, every now and then.
Internet-provided TV.
Yes, internet-provided TV.
To clarify your own term.
Yes, my own term. I think the barriers are rising.
Okay.
And I think that we're headed towards things, an opportunity for a company like Facebook to just start making a second YouTube, where all of a sudden there's now a video. I mean, MySpace tried it too late, but where there's going to be someone's going to break out and start something new, where people have an opportunity again to be well known.
The dam's going to break and a new reservoir is going to be filling.
Right. And it's going to keep happening place to place. The higher adoption of availability of video, higher penetration of high-speed internet, I think is really going to help. But I think right now what we're headed towards is these new old boys clubs,
okay.
that you can't make money unless you're in, and you can't get in unless you make money.
I think from my view on the next 5 to 10 years...
As pessimistic as I could be, I suppose.
No, you're coming from the dystopian view of the future, you know, very, very positive. I want to say the baseline. I've always looked at podcast networks, particularly your Revision 3s or Twits, which were the most popular, are still, I think, the most successful ones.
That aren't National Public Radio.
True. Okay. Because everyone, like, literally, This American Life and, you know, Radiolab, very popular.
I don't know if there's anyone with an iPhone that uses it for podcasts that doesn't have This American Life loaded in some content on their phone.
That's true. But I think the one thing particular with Revision 3 and Tech TV, CNET's Buzz Out Loud, you know, or just CNET in general, is that they all came from Tech TV. I mean, this is very general, very based. I mean, CNET was still separate, but all those popular podcasts networks came out of San Francisco's Tech TV large circle of people. And you have people who are spreading off of that who are then connected to these other people. So it's very interconnected networks of people. And I think that because of that, that's why you're getting this. It's almost like the effect of when Trent Reznor and David Bowie gave away their music as Creative Commons titles. They can still make a shit ton of money, pardon my language, at concerts because they already have the popularity. Other artists are not going to make the same level of money because they're still new, they're still untested, they still don't have necessarily that cult following yet. I think the level of money people will make will drop because they're not as popular from the get-go. Like you're not going to see actors making $20 million salaries a year from television shows they create on the internet. I think you're going to see a return to the BBC style of television shows in America if it goes through internet-provided television, because of the fact that budgets are going to be cut, actors are going to be, you know, treated like you're not going to be a major show. We're going to do short runs. Like in the UK, for example, shows over there have always been done because all BBC television is paid for by British taxpayers. They actually have one of the best IPTV networks when it comes to their iPlayer, which allows you to watch the show streaming live when they're broadcasted. Because of that too, because they demanded it. But what I think you're going to see is, I think TV shows that start to become popular that are created through online publications or online producing shows like your, The Guild, for example, are very grassroots, very, very tight budgets. Belts are very, very tight. And I think that you're going to see how the BBC takes a year between each show come to television production in America. You're already starting to see the interesting, in normal TV, you're starting to get the off-season shows. Like, I think what was interesting is you started seeing Sci-Fi and USA Networks being the most progressive in how they do TV, where it's like, we have three shows that are running during the summer, we have three shows that are running during the fall. No matter what, there's always some show that you like. So there's not this entire summer of dead air anymore. You're having these off weird seasons where the show runs from halfway through July to December, and then there's nothing till the next halfway through July, but they always have something that replaces it. I think you're going to see a very much focused on a rotating factoring like that, where there's a lot more time for production and post-production for shows, and you're going to see community-generated content. I think you already see that with content for blogs in itself, examples being like GDDT, done by Peter Rojas and Ryan Block, where all the content's created by the users. You have that with YouTube, but I think you're going to get that level of high-end quality through things that are funded by Kickstarter, which is a site to allow you get funding. You know, you'll see someone say, I like that plot idea, I want to see that. And you might start getting that kind of, you know, same, you know, you did one job, let's keep going. I still think, though, a lot of podcasts right now and internet-provided TV is still limited based on the fact that people are still finding their voice. You still have the biggest popular people who are making the most money because people knew what they were in traditional media. And you see, for example, Penn Jillette, who now has his Penn Chat on Revision 3, and he had Bullshit on Showtime. I think his stuff is popular just because, you know, he is that, you know, David Bowie, Trent Reznor type. You know, he already had a cult following from traditional media. And once you start seeing them more and more move over to non-traditional media, you'll, you know, get that over. I mean, good examples you see this now is in advertising, particularly like, for example, the Old Spice commercials. I mean, literally for the last 3 days, how many people have not seen a Twitter feed related to someone posting a response from the actor in Old Spice? I mean, for Pete's sake, even Mr. Babyman, the most, you know, notorious dig user, what had a response to him. Like, you know, the Old Spice guy saying, is he a baby with manly muscles or is he a man with a baby's, you know, soft skin? You know, you're having popularity based on usernames now, like forum boards are, you know, you're getting people known for that. And I think that content will be generated more from outside sources. The viral videos, which now become the viral commercial videos, will now bring the commercial television shows to the internet. I think, though, it's going to be interesting to see exactly what happens with traditional media. Looking at content production, content is going to get out there. releases from movies are going to be out there because there's demand in foreign markets. We look at piracy, for example, this. In Russia, you have your DVD-quality-made movies released the same day they're released in the United States because they know people are going to pirate it otherwise, so why not buy it now? And so now I'm able to get a copy of Kick-Ass or you name a movie in DVD quality with no difference between the American version and that, just subtitles that I can turn on and off because the wonders of the internet right now with different video codec formats. I think another issue is the fact that you're going to have a need with content for the internet, Creative Commons licenses. The license, I think, is the biggest next step for a lot of content creation. Talking to people from PBS and Corporation of Public Broadcasting, there's a lot of content that is held up in their archives because the fact is they're orphan works or their content where the producer just doesn't want to give it away. Talking to one of their VPs of marketing digital strategy, which is basically their digital marketing strategy, they have videos of Martin Luther King talking to Malcolm X in an interview of them, you know, going at each other with jibes, talking about their different points of where they stood on, you know, pro-violence or non-violence. And that video has only been seen once since 1969, you know, relatively speaking. And I think that's the next big step is getting users understanding what licensing of their content is. You know, someone posts a video to YouTube, but do they understand what goes with posting that video? I mean, someone can then reuse it. I think a good example we need to look at is, like, for example, Jonathan Colton posting his videos on YouTube and then having them reposted to Spike TV where they make money off ads. There was a whole big video debate about that where, technically speaking, based on the amount that Viacom sued Google for on YouTube for their, like, videos of their shows being put on there, they should pay him $17,000. But in reality, based on new metrics that they used, they should actually be paying him $17. And they're like, which one do you want to pay? And, you know, Viacom was saying, you should pay us this from the Google. And then vice versa, when people complain about their content on their site, it's actually this much we made from advertising. And I think licensing, copyright, production, money is some of the biggest issues still with it. And I think, first off, people need to know what their rights are when it comes down to the content they produce.
And someone needs to have a legal definition of what non-commercial means.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of a legal definition yet.
I mean, I actually recently myself, from photos I took at South by Southwest, after hearing this whole debate with advertising with Jonathan Colton's videos, I actually found other people who are using photos of mine. They had given me attribution, you know, the traditional part of non-creative commons. They linked to my site, but they had advertisements on their websites. They had banner ads. So they were making money based on the content of articles they were writing, then using my photos. So I sent them emails to let them know that, you know, technically speaking, you owe me money. Here's how much you would owe me based on, you know, how many clicks. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh my God, we'll take it down. I'm like, I just want to let you know this could be someone else. I'm going to let you guys use the photos because I think in sharing them. But I think that's another issue as well, is that no one knows that your content can be, you know, it can be used by other people to make money, or vice versa, that you can make money from your content and how to share it properly. I think a lot of people have this very, to go political, pardon me on this one, there's a very libertarian focus on, you know, what's mine is mine, but at the same time, they don't understand exactly how that affects culture in the long run. And so I think television critiques and things like that are weird creatures that we have to deal with. We need our Lessigs to tell us, you know, how to do that.
Sounds like a topic for another show.
I think so. So, guys, why don't you tell us where we can find more of your work? Kelly?
That's a good question. Probably Twitter is usually where my most interesting stuff goes through. Or Tumblr. Tumblr or Twitter. Twitter is just Kelly Sutton. Tumblr is also kellysutton.tumblr.com.
Okay.
You can find my blog at amateursuperhero.com. And then also, I'd like to take a moment to plug imdboner.com. imdboner.com.
And what is imdboner?
imdboner is speaking of non-commercial. imdboner is we take movie posters and replace one word with the word boner.
I've seen that. The same. That's amazing.
Well, that's me. That's with the same. It's me and two other guys. With
a good friend of the podcast, yes, Gavin St. Ars
and Chris Willits, who runs an excellent cheap in New York site, The Skint. But It's literally like you took a sticker with the word boner on it, put it over a word in a movie poster, so you wind up with things like Passion of the Boner or Boner of the Christ, Nightmare on Boner Street, Friday the Boner or Boner the 13th, things
like
that.
It's all user-generated content. For sure.
It's, well, partially us, partially user-generated, but yeah.
But a lot of it is user-submitted with the – you have the Tumblr feed for it that allows people to send up the
– Yeah, we allow submissions and – we usually, if you want, we give credit. If you don't want, we don't give credit. But, yeah, we've got a few hundred up there now and continually pushing forward.
And that boner is growing.
Yes. And on Twitter, Rob Blatt, R-O-B-B-L-A-T-T.
This has been your host, Patrick Roanhouse. You can find more of the Plan 8 Podcast at plan8ts.com or just look for us on Google at the Plan 8 Podcast. You can find me at Roanhouse, R-O-A-N-H-O-U-S-C on Twitter. And feel free to contact the podcast at any time with our email address at podcast@plan8ts.com. And also, you can leave a voicemail for the podcast at phone number 410-929-2009. And just to close out with our sponsors, remember to use code PLAN83 to save 10% off of your entire order at GoDaddy.com. And also, check out Voice over IP service, VoIPO, and use the address VoIPO.com/2179. Remember, by helping our sponsors, you help us continue this podcast. And thank you for listening to the Plan 8 Podcast.